So Essie's baby boy, whom she called Anthony, after, she said, her late husband his father, knowing that there was none there to contradict her, and perhaps she had known an Anthony once, sucked at Essie's breast, alongside of Phillida Richardson, and her employer's child always got first suck. So she grew into a healthy child, tall and strong, while Essie's son grew weak and rickety on what was left. And along with the milk, the children as they grew drank Essie's tales of the knockers and the blue caps who lived down the mines, of the bucca, the tricksiest spirit of the land, much more dangerous than the red-headed snub-nosed piskies, for whom the first fish of the catch was always left upon the shingle, and for whom a fresh-baked loaf of bread was left in the field at reaping time to ensure a fine harvest. She told them of the apple tree men, old apple trees who talked when they had a mind, and who needed to be placated with the first cider of the crop, which was poured onto their roots as the year turned, if they were to give you a fine crop for the next year. She told them in her mellifluous Cornish drawl which trees they should be wary of, in the old rhyme, "Elm he do brood, and oak he do hate, but the willow man goes walking if he stays out late." She told them all these things, and they believed, because she believed. The farm prospered, and Essie Tregowan placed a china saucer of milk outside the back door each night for the piskies. And after 8 months, John Richardson came a knocking quietly on Essie's bedroom door and asked her for favors of the kind a woman shows a man. And Essie told him how shocked and hurt she was, a poor widow woman, and an indentured servant no better than a slave, to be asked to prostitute herself for a man whom she had so much respect for, and an indentured servant could not marry. So how he could even think to torment an indentured transportee girl so she could not bring herself to think. And her nut-brown eyes filled with tears, such that Richardson found himself apologizing to her, and the upshot of it was that John Richardson wound up in that corridor of that hot summer's night, going down on one knee to Essie Tregowan and proposing an end to her indenture and offering his hand in marriage. Now, although she accepted him, she would not sleep a night with him until it was legal, whereupon she moved from the little room in the attic to the master bedroom in the front of the house. And if some of Farmer Richardson's friends and their wives cut him when next they saw him in town, many more of them were of the opinion that the new Mistress Richardson was a damn fine-looking woman, and that Johnny Richardson had done quite well for himself. Within a year she was delivered of another child, another boy, but as blonde as his father and his half-sister, and they named him John, after his father. The three children went to the local church to hear the traveling preacher on Sundays, and they went to the little school to learn their letters and their numbers with the children of the other small farmers, while Essie also made sure they knew the mysteries of the piskies, which were the most important mysteries there were. Red-headed men with eyes and clothes as green as a river, with turned-up noses, funny squinting men who would, if they got a mind to, turn you and twist you and lead you out of your way unless you had salt in your pocket, or a little bread. When the children went off to school, they each of them carried a little salt in one pocket, a little bread in the other, the old symbols of life and the earth, to make sure they came safely home once more. And they always did. The children grew in the lush Virginia hills, grew tall and strong, although Anthony, her first son, was always weaker, paler, more prone to disease and bad airs. And the Richardsons were happy, and Essie loved her husband as best she could. They had been married a decade when John Richardson developed a toothache so bad it made him fall from his horse. They took him to the nearest town where his tooth was pulled, but it was too late, and the blood poisoning carried him off, black-faced and groaning, and they buried him beneath his favorite willow tree. The widow Richardson was left the farm to manage until Richardson's two children were of age. She managed the indentured servants and the slaves and brought in the tobacco crop, year in, year out. She poured cider on the roots of the apple trees on New Year's Eve and placed a loaf of new baked bread in the fields at harvest time, and she always left a saucer of milk at the back door. The farm flourished, and the Widow Richardson gained a reputation as a hard bargainer, but one whose crop was always good, and who never sold shoddy for better merchandise. So all went well for another 10 years. But after that was a bad year, for Anthony, her son, slew Johnny, his half-brother, in a furious quarrel over the future of the farm and the disposition of Phillida's hand. And some said he had not meant to kill his brother and that it was a foolish blow that struck too deep. And some said otherwise. Anthony fled, leaving Essie to bury her youngest son beside his father. Now some said Anthony fled to Boston, and some said he went south to Florida, and his mother was of the opinion that he had taken ship to England to enlist in George's army and fight the rebel Scots. But with both sons gone, the farm was an empty place, and a sad one, and Phillida pined and plained as if her heart had been broken, while nothing that her stepmother could say or do would put a smile back on her lips again. But heartbroken or not, they needed a man about the farm. And so Phillida married Harry Soames, a ship's carpenter by profession who had tired of the sea and who dreamed of a life on land on a farm like the Lincolnshire farm upon which he had grown up. And although the Richardsons' farm was little enough like that, Harry Soames found correspondences enough to make him happy. 5 children were born to Phillida and Harry, 3 of whom lived. The Widow Richardson missed her sons, and she missed her husband, although he was now little more than a memory of a fair man who treated her kindly. Phillida's children would come to Essie for tales, and she would tell them of the black dog of the moors, and of raw head and bloody bones, or the apple tree man. But they were not interested. They only wanted tales of Jack, Jack up the beanstalk, or Jack giant killer, or Jack and his cat and the king. She loved those children as if they were her own flesh and blood, although sometimes she would call them by the names of those long dead. It was May, and she took her chair out into the kitchen garden to pick peas and to shuck them in the sunlight, for even in the lush heat of Virginia the cold had entered her bones as the frost had entered her hair, and a little warmth was a fine thing. As the Widow Richardson shucked the peas with her old hands, she got to thinking about how fine it would be to walk once more on the moors and the salty cliffs of her native Cornwall. And she thought of sitting on the shingle as a little girl waiting for her father's boat to return from the grey seas. Her hands, blue-knuckled and clumsy, opened the peapods, forced the full peas into an earthenware bowl and dropped the empty peapods onto her aproned lap. And then she found herself remembering, as she had not remembered for a long time, a life well lost. How she had twitched purses and filched silks with her clever fingers. And now she remembers the warden of Newgate telling her that it would be a good 12 weeks before her case would be heard, and that she could escape the gallows if she could plead her belly. And what a pretty thing she was. And how she had turned to the wall and bravely lifted her skirts, hating herself and hating him, but knowing he was right, and the feel of the life quickening inside her that meant that she could cheat death for a little longer.
"Essie Tregowan?"
said the stranger. The Widow Richardson looked up, shading her eyes in the May sunshine.
"Do I know ye?"
she asked. She had not heard him approach. The man was dressed all in green, dusty green trews, green jacket, and a dark green coat. His hair was a carroty red, and he grinned at her all lopsided. There was something about the man that made her happy to look at him, and something else that whispered of danger.
"You might say that you know me."
He squinted down at her, and she squinted right back up at him, searching his moon face for a clue to his identity. He looked as young as one of her own grandchildren, yet he had called her by her old name, and there was a burr in his voice she knew from her childhood. from the rocks and the moors of her home.
You're a Cornishman.